I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/spoken today.
Want to teach your kids financial literacy, but not sure where to start? Greenlight can help. With Greenlight, parents can keep an eye on kids' spending and saving, while kids and teens use a card of their own to build money confidence. As a parent, you can send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and more. It's a convenient way to run your household, customized to your family's needs, and the easy way to raise financially smart kids. Get started with Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/ACAST.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. As a podcast listener, you've heard from us before. Today, let's hear from our members about what online therapy has done for them.
I would recommend my therapist 1,000 times over. She has truly changed my life.
The day after my first session, my friends and family said I sounded like myself again for the first time in weeks.
You deserve to invest in your well-being. Visit BetterHelp.com to see what it can do for you. That's BetterHelp.com.
The ocean, it's 70% of the entire habitat on the planet. So that of itself is a huge statement showing how important it is to think about the ocean, to protect the ocean. It's just hard to do that because we can't always see the harm that we're causing. It's like this blanket that we have to peer underneath to really know what's happening.
When I think about the future, I can't help but wonder what kind of world will be waiting for kids like me. Will we still be able to snorkel along coral reefs and turquoise tropical water? Will we be able to see the stars on a clear night? Will we still be able to find all the fruits and vegetables we love from our local grocery stores? I'd like to think so. That's why I'm trying to learn as much as I can about climate change science, stories, and solutions, and share what I learn with all of you. Together, we can decide what type of future we want for our planet, and discover the power we have in shaping it. This is We the Children, the podcast where kids talk climate change. I'm Zach, your host. I'm 12 years old and live in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Claire, Zach's teacher and fellow eco-enthusiast. What's on the agenda this week, Zach?
Today, we're meeting someone who spends more time beneath the ocean than anyone else we've encountered.
My name is Molly Timmers, and I'm a marine ecologist for the National Geographic Society's flagship conservation program called Pristine Seas.
As a kid, Molly was always outside. She loved nature. Actually, she dreamt of one day becoming a park ranger. But as soon as she was exposed to the ocean, her idea of a dream job quickly changed.
I found it really intriguing. Unlike land, where you're looking into the forest and you see everything visually so easily, the ocean, it's like this blanket, and you have no idea what's underneath unless you jump in. And there is this excitement and adventure and diving and being underwater that really drew me more towards ocean research.
That fascination for the hidden ecosystems beneath the waves has led to over two decades of experience in the field. And during that time, she's witnessed the beauty and fragility of marine life firsthand. From colorful coral reefs teeming with life to the mysterious depths of the ocean, not to mention sharks, Molly's adventures have taken her to some of the most remote and pristine corners of the globe. But Molly isn't just an ocean explorer. She's also a tireless advocate for marine conservation. Through her work with Pristine Seas Program and other initiatives, she's been at the forefront of efforts to protect our ocean's environments for future generations. In today's episode, we'll learn about Molly's remarkable journey, discussing everything from the challenges facing our oceans to the innovative technologies shaping the future of marine research. Get ready to dive deep into the world of marine ecology with Molly Timmers. Has the ocean always been an interest of yours?
I love being under the water. It is completely silent besides everything that you may hear in terms of the fish chomping or the snapping shrimp. you know, those natural sounds, in addition to your bubbles, that's what you hear. And you just feel like you are in the moment. So much of our life right now composes of all these electronics that are constantly distracted from us. When you're underwater, there's nothing you really do but focus on being there. And it is just one of the most comforting and rewarding experiences. When I first started, it was, you know, it's always a little daunting when you first start and you're like, am I really going to be breathing underwater? It's such a foreign concept to you. And you go down and you have that initial butterflies and your heart's racing and you have that second guessing of what am I doing? But it's those type of moments that I feel like I really try to push myself and challenge myself, because it just, you just feel better. You're like, I can do this. And that was when I initially started. And once you're in the water, it's just amazing. When you're floating and you're just in like this three-dimensional space, right? You can move up, down, sideways, left. On land, you're just walking forward and backwards practically. But in the water, you've got a whole other upward dimension that you can access. And it's amazing to be under there and swim with the fish. And at night, seeing the bioluminescence, it's really neat.
Can you talk us through how your work with coral reefs began?
My first job related to coral reefs was what I like to call being a high seas garbage collector. So it was in the Hawaiian Islands. It's this unique archipelago. It's the most remote archipelago on the planet, and it sits in the Pacific, north of the equator.
Definition time. An archipelago is a group or chain of islands clustered together, typically in a sea or ocean. These islands are usually formed by volcanic activity, tectonic plate movements, or coral reef growth.
And there's this North Pacific gyra. So a gyra is like a current system that's circular, that moves around the Hawaiian Islands. And marine debris from fishing vessels, like nets that are discarded or have been lost at sea, gets stuck in that current pattern. And the Hawaiian Islands serve as like a comb, and the currents push it over. And what happens is that nets, they end up getting stuck onto the reefs and the corals and entangle sea life. And they started this marine debris removal project where they sent people out to the northwestern Hawaiian Islands to free dive, scuba, and remove all of this fishing gear. So I started my first real job working in water on scuba and free diving was as a marine debris removal technician. From the marine debris field work, I transitioned into joining a group called the Coral Reef Ecosystem Division in Hawaii. And it was established to assess and monitor all of the coral reefs in the U.S. Pacific Islands. So this organization would go out on research vessels to these different locations months at a time and scuba dive to survey fish, corals, invertebrates, the oceanography, the algae. And so I was a member of those teams surveying mostly the inverts in the benthic community.
Hey Claire, do you know what Molly means by the benthic community?
Benthic refers to anything at the bottom of the sea. And the animals and plants that live on or in the bottom of the ocean are known as benthos.
What are coral reefs exactly?
So coral reefs are essentially an underwater ecosystem. And it's an ecosystem formed by corals. They're like the foundational species. So in a forest, your foundational species are trees. So in a coral reef ecosystem, they're corals. And corals are these sessile, or meaning they don't move, organisms that create a calcium carbonate skeleton, so like limestone, and they build up and they form a bunch of the structure and the complexity that you see on a coral reef. And so what that does is that it forms habitat for a variety of different organisms. And because it forms all of this complex habitat, more organisms can live there. And that's partially why coral reefs are such high biodiversity ecosystems.
Molly's early work involved collaborating with NOAA, or the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. NOAA is focused on studying and protecting the ocean and atmosphere. Initially, her research involved traditional methods, such as direct observation, data collection, and analysis, to study various aspects of marine ecology and biodiversity. However, as technology advanced, Molly's research methods evolved. She began incorporating more advanced techniques to survey the ocean. How has your work changed over time?
So for the first half of my life, I really targeted scuba diving. And then the second half of my career was focused on also scuba diving, but complementing it with ways of understanding organisms that I can't necessarily observe when I'm diving. And this is where this method called environmental DNA has really taken forth.
Environmental DNA sampling allows researchers to extract and analyze genetic material from water samples to identify the presence of different organisms in an ecosystem.
And if you can think about it, it's pretty crazy. If you collect a couple bags of water and you look at that, you don't see anything. But if I was to tell you there's probably 30 to 50 organisms in there, not microbes, you may think that I'm just teasing you, that this really isn't what's happening inside this water. But if we step back and think of the ecosystem and think of DNA, these small, tiny particles, DNA is released constantly. So there's all this DNA that is in the water that you can collect, and you try to extract it. And what extract means is just taking that DNA out of the water and amplifying it. So you try to make loads and loads and loads of replicates of this DNA, amplify it so that you can sequence it and find out what's in the water.
Molly's transition from traditional marine research methods to utilizing advanced technologies like environmental DNA sampling really highlights the role of technology in advancing marine science and conservation efforts. It also speaks to the opportunities and often challenges associated with integrating new tech into not just research practices, but our everyday lives. How has technology been useful in your life when learning about climate solutions or energy consumption? How do you think the future of technology can positively influence climate change?
So let me explain how it complements our whole diving mission, for example. So we have a bunch of us going out into the field on coral reefs. We have people counting fish. We have people like myself doing inverts and benthic stuff, corals and algae. And when we come out of the water, we have this immediate snapshot of what types of organisms are in the system. Now, I also collect water there, and I target organisms that are not easily observed. So what the eDNA does, we have this information from the site. Now we have way more information on organisms that were not seen by the divers. And so we elevate and we increase the overall picture and biodiversity across groups of organisms using this tool. So because we are focused on the biodiversity and how things can change or are different across space, this tool helps really look at a much bigger picture of the ecosystem. And the exciting thing about this tool is that 10 years from now or 20 years from now, people can take this data and reevaluate it and get better resolution of the sequences that are being captured. What's needed with eDNA are barcodes of organisms, and a barcode is like a fingerprint. And there's a lot of organisms out there that we don't know what their DNA signature is or their fingerprint. As we start getting more of those barcodes, this information that we are gathering now, the sequences, the water that we're filtering, extracting, and amplifying can be examined again in 20 years when we have way more barcodes to refine the resolution and have a better picture of these locations.
Amazingly, eDNA can go far beyond the coral reef. It can actually capture stuff from the bathypelagic, which is a zone below 1,000 meters, between 3,300 and 9,800 feet below the surface of the ocean, to be exact. Now that's deep, and very dark.
It's not a place we venture too often. What happens are some of these fish end up coming up to the surface to feed, or their larvae end up going to the surface before they sink back down. And with the ocean currents and the movement, we're actually picking up DNA signals from these organisms in coastal nearshore habitat. eDNA is also a functioning tool in places where a scuba diver just can't reach.
What role do coral reefs play in our global ecosystem?
Interestingly, there are nearly a billion people who live within something like 100 kilometers of the ocean. And there's something on the order of like 500 million or 500 million people that actually use coral reefs for food, for protection. Protection, I mean by coastal protection. So coral reefs form this barrier that limit wave energy from hitting the shoreline too hard. And then tourism, for example, people wanting to go out and scuba or snorkel, they're paying money to see coral reefs. So they're actually also providing an income.
What are some of the greatest challenges or threats facing coral reefs?
There are a lot of threats to coral reefs. You've got climate change, you've got pollution, you have sedimentation, invasive species, you've got overfishing, you have marine debris. There's a series of different impacts, both locally and globally. So like a local impact would be the sedimentation, the pollution, the overfishing in a near coastal community. Global impacts are things that are happening across the globe that aren't directly related completely to a coastal community living near a reef. So those would be like ocean warming and ocean acidification.
Definition time. Ocean acidification is a process by which carbon dioxide from the atmosphere is absorbed by the ocean. This leads to a decrease in seawater pH. Simply put, this acidification is bad for all marine organisms like coral, shellfish, and plankton because they can't build and maintain their calcium carbonate-based structures, which impacts their survival greatly. It also alters the marine ecosystems, which is not always reversible. Ultimately, it leads to shifts in ecosystem composition. But stopping ocean acidification starts with addressing CO2 emissions here on land.
I think many people don't realize how much impact we have on the ocean system. And that's partially because it's very hard to visually see the impact. Like on a land, if somebody deforests a place, you see that. If there's a massive bleaching event underwater and all the corals go away, very few people see it. They don't connect to that because they can't be there. People need to be aware of all of the ecosystem services, the oxygen it produces, the climate control it has on our planet is super important. And if anyone likes to eat anything from the ocean, we need to try to sustain it. And there's lots of things that are impacting that. The plastic that people are tossing, if it ends up in the ocean, it ends up breaking down. It turns into microplastics. Fish are ingesting that. It's accumulating in their system. And then the fish is being caught and you're eating that fish. So you start getting some of these issues within your body over time. So we have to be conscientious that it doesn't matter where we are, our actions have an impact on this planet.
What happens to coral reefs when the ocean's temperature warms?
When the temperature increases in the ocean above a certain threshold that a coral is tolerant of, what happens is they kind of get sick. So when you get sick, you tend to have a fever, and you sweat it out to try to control that fever. When the ocean warms up, a coral essentially is getting a fever. But instead of sweating that fever, what happens is their zooxanthellae get released. So coral have a really interesting relationship with these microalgae called zooxanthellae. So algae photosynthesize just like plants do on land. And what happens with this symbiotic relationship, so when I say symbiotic, I mean it's mutually beneficial to each other, the polyps on a coral will take in these zooxanthellae. That's what gives a coral its color. And the zooxanthellae takes sunlight, creates nutrients, and the coral receives some of that nutrients that help it grow and survive. In return, the coral houses the zooxanthellae, so they live mutually together. So when the temperature increases over 4 weeks of the coral temperature threshold, above the temperature threshold, what happens is the zooxanthellae are released from the polyps, and the corals are essentially defending for themselves to get as much nutrients as possible. Now, if the temperature goes down eventually, a lot of times the corals can recover and the zooxanthellae will re-enter. But if there's long extended periods, that's when there's these long bleaching events.
Coral bleaching happens when the water is too warm and the corals will expel the algae, zooxanthellae, living in their tissues. This causes the coral to turn completely white.
And if it's past 8 weeks or more, a number of times, what happens is the corals can't live and get enough nutrients, and they end up dying. And once they start dying, that's when you see those white skeletons on the reef of a dead coral. And it's basically because all the zooxanthellae have left them and hadn't returned because the temperature was too high.
We interrupt this program for a local weather bulletin, where you find out how climate change has affected the weather where guests and listeners live. This week, marine ecologist Molly Timmers talks about Hawaii's rising temperatures and sea levels.
So here in Hawaii, we have been experiencing in the past couple decades rising temperatures. And so those rising temperatures can cause those corals to bleach. So we haven't experienced as much detriment of bleaching as other places, but it's still happening, and it's happening more frequently.
Thanks, Molly, and thanks for keeping a close eye on those coral reefs. Now, we want to hear from you. If you'd like to provide a local weather report about how climate change is impacting your home, please visit wethechildrenpodcast.com, fill out the consent form, and drop Zach a voicemail.
There have been reports about the Great Barrier Reef recovering from coral bleaching, and I was wondering if that's true and if you can talk about what the recovery process for coral is like.
After the massive bleaching events in 2016 and 2017, there was something on the order of close to 90% coral die-off in certain areas on the Great Barrier Reef, and that would cause great concern. And then 4 to 5 years later, in 2022, coral cover on the Great Barrier Reef and over half of the reefs was greater than it ever has been for something like 30, 35 years. So the coral had recovered, and it was an incredible sight to see. A lot of the corals that they found, even the coral cover was high, were of what you would call a weedy species. So there are certain corals that grow faster than others, and they tend to be the first to just populate an area, and they happen to survive and increase the coral cover.
How do changes in the ocean affect our life on planet Earth?
The ocean provides something along the words of like at least 2/3 of the oxygen that's produced. So us just breathing, we're reliant on the ocean. The current system, the deep current system in the ocean, it helps cool our planet as well. If we didn't have the trade winds and the currents and the upwelling that occurs, there would be shifts in fisheries, or fisheries wouldn't be as abundant in certain locations. And that could impact us when you think of the economics on a global scale. So the ocean, it's 70% of the entire habitat on the planet. So that of itself is a huge statement showing how important it is to think about the ocean, to protect the ocean. It's just hard to do that because we can't always see the harm that we're causing inside the ocean. Because like I said in the beginning, it's like this blanket that we have to peer underneath to really know what's happening.
What are some of the most successful methods of coral reef protection and conservation that you've seen or heard about?
Some successful methods towards coral conservation include establishing no fishing marine protected areas, like a no-take marine protected area.
A no-take zone is a marine protected area that does not allow any fishing, mining, drilling, or other extractive activities. Removing or destroying natural or cultural resources is strictly prohibited. Though marine reserves are rare in the U.S., with only about 3% of U.S. waters in these no-take zones.
By having a no-take marine protected area, you're able to protect the fish. And the fish serve as a variety of functions. One group in particular, the herbivores, they're like the lawn mowers on a coral reef. They eat all the algae. And when they're absent, you have a lot of algae, and the coral are competing with algae for space, because space on the bottom of the ocean is the primary thing that all these organisms are competing each other for. So if you don't have any space, the coral reefs can't continue growing or can't recruit to. So in the Great Barrier Reef, when we had just talked about it before, the fish and the micrograzers may have been keeping some of the algae down so that there are areas for the coral recruitment to grow. So if you establish a marine protected area, that helps just let life survive on its own without any human influence. Other things that have helped coral reef systems include land-based management practices. So targeting upstream agriculture and other developmental products to limit any sort of nutrients that may run into a reef. There have been projects working on the land side to try to limit sedimentation and runoff that can influence the reef. Some of the conservation things I do personally is I don't buy anything with plastic, or try not to as much as possible. Like if I go shopping, I bring my own bags, not only my own bags for groceries, but my own bags for the fruits and the vegetables and the bulk. If there's anything, we all have those inklings of desire to purchase something, but I tend to sit there and think, do I really need that? Is that something that is really necessary in my life? We are such a consumer culture that we forget the resources it takes to produce all those reindeer sweaters and other things that may not be necessary is extracting resources that, you know, eventually go into a landfill or even into the ocean. So it's being conscientious of what you purchase and how you try to limit the things in your life.
We've all purchased that spur-of-the-moment bottle of water or filled up a plastic bag at the grocery store checkout line. But plastic, especially single-use plastic, has a major environmental impact. And after it's thrown away, a fair percentage of it seems to find its way into the ocean. Can you think of areas in your life where you can cut down on plastics? And can you think of an alternative you could use? Like, instead of a plastic water bottle, you use a reusable glass or metal bottle. Or instead of wrapping your food in plastic wrap, you could use a beeswax wrap.
What's interesting about Molly's work is also her commute. Boats play a big role in the work she does, and she's spent quite a bit of her life on the high seas.
On paper, I'm a marine ecologist, but I'm really a field biologist. I've spent over 2 decades of my life in the field. If you were to accumulate all of that time, it'd be over 6 years on a boat studying these places.
Wow, being a marine ecologist sounds amazing, except maybe for the part in the beginning when Molly was essentially being dragged behind the boat as shark bait. I think I could skip that part. It's almost as if the ocean is an entirely different planet where scientists are making new discoveries all the time. It sounds like something so rich with life is worth protecting at all costs. But to Molly's point, sometimes the things we can't see are the easiest to put out of our minds. That's why conservation efforts to protect our oceans and marine ecosystems are vital, not only for all the creatures living under the sea, but for our well-being here on land. It's a good reminder that our actions, no matter how distant from the ocean, have a profound impact on its health, and it's worth diving deeper into awareness, innovation, and conservation to ensure a thriving ocean for generations to come.
That's right, Claire. And like the famous oceanographer Jacques Cousteau once said, the sea, once it casts its spell, holds one in its net of wonder forever. Speaking of wonder, I wonder what today's quiz questions are.
Hey, I can tell you that. Today's three quiz questions are: 1. What does benthic refer to? 2. What's an example of a successful method of coral reef protection? And 3. Why are coral reefs such high biodiversity ecosystems?
Thanks, Claire. Please check out our Facebook and Instagram, at We The Children Podcast, to find this week's quiz questions and post your answers there. Or you can visit www.wethechildrenpodcast.com and leave us a voice message with your responses. We might even play them on our next episode, where we'll reveal the correct answers. Speaking of correct answers, here are the correct answers to last week's quiz about water conservation.
Hi, Zach. I'm Eloise, and I'm from Portland, Maine.
1. What do you call a drought that has lasted over 20 years?
A drought that has lasted over 20 years is called a mega drought.
2. What percentage of water usage goes towards landscaping activities like watering lawns?
Over 50% of water is used for watering lawns.
3. Can you name at least 3 states that the Colorado River passes through?
California, Utah, and Arizona.
Thanks for playing, Eloise, and thanks for listening. Subscribe to We the Children on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, we, the children, have the power to make a difference for our planet. Until next time, we'll leave you with today's voice of hope, our previous guest, environmental activist Laitania Bailai-Jondam.
Climate activism, or activism in general, tends to be associated with anger and hopelessness and despair. But I'm a big advocate for climate joy, and that there's a lot of joy that comes from working in this place as well. One of my friends who is also a youth activist, her name is Michaela Loach. She mentions that joy doesn't betray activism, but sustains it. And I love that quote so much. I think it's so true that we don't always have to be angry and pointing fingers and sad and hopeless. We can also be joyful. And joy is a big part of sustaining our work. Because if we're not happy with the work that we are doing, how can we continue to do it for a long time?
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
The Real Housewives is a guilty pleasure for most. But if you're looking to not feel guilty about that pleasure, tune in to Everything Iconic with me, Danny Pellegrino, where I break down all the messy moments and behind-the-scenes antics of Bravo's popular franchise. And on Everything Iconic, I also interview celebrity guests like Kelly Ripa, Kiki Palmer, Drew Barrymore, Cameron Diaz, and more about their guilty pleasures, their past work, and so much more. So if you're pop culture obsessed and find yourself watching way too much reality TV like me, tune in to Everything Iconic with Danny Pellegrino, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.